This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Well, would you look at that? It's only a new episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Hello! Yes, welcome along. My name is Dan. This is the only show around that can take you on a trip to the deepest, most dark and dangerous places in the universe, but make sure that you're back in time for dinner so your mum don't get mad. Now today, actually, speaking of the universe, we're chatting to a space expert all about meteors and the water that is frozen on them and why that might hold the key to life. Also, we'll chat about an airport that is so dangerous, only 8 pilots are brave enough to land there. And we'll learn which creature in the sea can dive the deepest. First, let's find out the secret of why you can listen to what I'm saying right now. This is from our speakers series on Fun Kids.
The speakers. Transmission. Getting your message across.
Woof, Subbo and Tweet are speakers with a lot to say. But how best can they get other people to listen?
Here, check out my new track, guys. This is going to be the next big thing.
That's pretty cool, Woof. What do you think, honkers? But to be the next big thing, you're going to need to get loads of people to hear your track. How are you going to do that?
Well, I was thinking of driving around playing it really loudly on the CD player in the car.
Brilliant. Oh, but what if you're moving too fast?
Yeah, maybe a mobile disco isn't such a great idea. Okay, maybe I could call people on my mobile and play it down the phone.
Talking on the phone is definitely a great way to communicate, but that could run up a big bill. Hey, why not put on a show?
Good thinking, with me as the headline act.
If you put on a show, you could send out lots of invitations and make lots of posters. Writing is a great way to get your message across. Hey, I'm brilliant at that. I'll give you a hand. I'm writing a fantastic story at the moment, as a matter of fact. Maybe I could read it out at your concert.
What's it about?
The Curse of the Haunted Honk.
Come on, it's not that bad.
I'm not sure my fans will go for that, but you could give it a go. So how are you going to get people to read your story?
Well, I was going to put it in a letter and post it to all my friends. That's another way to communicate. Trouble is, I have at least 7,000 friends, and that's a lot of stamps. Hey, you've only got a few mates, Woof. You could post your CDs for next to nothing.
Hey, very funny.
Hey, guys.
What's up, Tweet?
Hang on, just taking another selfie. And upload. Here's an idea. Why don't you put your stories and songs on the internet? I love communicating that way, and it's certainly a great way to connect with millions of people.
That's a great idea. Although, if we're on the internet all day, we're going to end up with an even bigger bill than Woof's mobile phone.
I guess. Hang on, we've forgotten something else. Like, something really obvious. Something that's in every single house in the country.
Radio and TV.
Of course. Radio's brilliant to transmit music to millions of people.
And television's great for dramas, sport and competitions.
It's time for Britain's Cake Factor.
And it's a great way for people to communicate and share ideas.
Will the honourable gentleman agree that the Prime Minister should refrain from picking his nose at the dispatch box?
Cool. Imagine if we could get on the radio or television. We'd reach loads of people without having to get in the car.
Or buying a million stamps.
And it wouldn't use up my phone or internet allowance either. I think we should investigate, guys. After all, who doesn't want to hear about my new outfit and all my amazing ideas and thoughts?
Ah, never mind that. Everyone will want to hear my story.
Forget that. It's my cool new song that's going to be the next big thing.
The Speakers Transmission with support from Arkiva. Find out more at funkidslive.com/speakers.
You can get loads of our episodes from the Speakers series. Find out all the different ways how sounds travel, how you hear music and noises. You can get them for free wherever you get your podcasts from. You know, places like iTunes. Also, they're on the Fun Kids app and you can have a listen at funkidslive.com. So I know that this is the show that takes you all around the world and we blast off through the atmosphere, but I need to just bring this down to earth for a second. Very simply and seriously, we need more reviews for the show on the iTunes podcast store. Please, if that is how you are listening to this show right now, do me a favour. Open up your phone or your tablet and open the iTunes podcast store on there. Leave us 5 stars, please, if you can. Write your name so I know who you are. And then there's a little comment box that you can see. Now, in that, I want you to leave me a sciencey question. You know, something about the world that you can't figure out, or maybe about the animals that live on it, or the stars that are twinkling in the sky. It doesn't matter. It just needs to be something sciencey. And then I will see it, and I'll get an expert on to answer it for you. Because then I guess it's win-win, you know? You get a lot smarter, and I get 5 nice, lovely stars. If you have a few minutes over the week, please, I'd love you to do it. I will see it. I'll make sure I give you a shout-out as well. Just open up the iTunes podcast store, find the Fun Kid Science Weekly, and leave us a review. It's the Fun Kid Science Weekly. Now, you know the sea that's all around you, yeah? Or you know the river that runs down the end of your road? Or you know the rain that falls from the sky? Well, get this. Some scientists, they think that maybe that water isn't from this planet after all. Tarek Daly is a planetary geologist at Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory in Maryland, and he's on the phone. Hey, Tarek.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, I thought we'd start with the basics. Could you just tell us what an asteroid actually is? I mean, we think it's just this rock from space, but go into a little bit more detail for us.
Certainly. So asteroids, as you say, are rocks in space, and they're leftovers, really, from the time when the solar system formed, you know, 4.6 billion years ago. Some of them are pretty big, like the size of the state of Texas in the U.S., and others are small, you know, down to the size of rocks you might find lying around a boulder in the backyard. But they're important to us because since they formed a really long time ago, back when the solar system formed, they contain clues. They're like fossils to the history of the early solar system.
And you did an experiment that was all about water and where our water comes from. What made you think about that? Tell me about the idea behind it.
Right. So we know that Earth has lots of water. As you mentioned, we have the, you know, oceans and so forth, and there's probably about an ocean's worth of water locked in the rocks inside of Earth. And the big question is, how did it get here? Where did it come from? And people have made some measurements of isotopes in Earth's oceans and also on the moon, and there's really good evidence to think that asteroids or bodies like asteroids are the things that brought Earth's water and water to other places in the inner solar system, like maybe Mars or Mercury or possibly Venus, although those are much drier today. So the big question was, okay, we have this hypothesis that people have worked on for a long time, but we wanted to kind of fill in the details of understanding how it actually got to be here.
I've seen a video of the experiment, and it looks like you had a lot of fun. Tell us more about what you did then. So you've got this big hypothesis. What do you do?
So the next thing we have to do is design an experiment to test it. And so, yes, the experiments themselves are a lot of fun. And what's really cool is that you can launch BB to marble-sized objects at the kinds of speeds that asteroids travel at.
And what speed are we
into planets?
What speed are we talking about, Tarek?
It's about 11,000, 12,000 miles per hour or 18,000 kilometers per hour.
Oh, yes.
Very fast, yes. But then we needed to launch something that would be similar to asteroids. Now, asteroids come in different types. We have meteorites on Earth, which are pieces of asteroids. And we knew that from Earth's meteorites, there is a particular kind of mineral, a building block of rocks, that carries water and carries water in asteroids. And that mineral is called serpentine. And so we did some poking around rocks on Earth to find some serpentine that we could use that had similar properties to the water-rich minerals in asteroids. And so we found some from a mountain belt in Japan that's this really nice, pure serpentine. And so now we had material that we could launch, this serpentine. So we have these water-rich materials, and we know how much water is in them. And the question is, how much of that water gets trapped when that object crashes into something else? And so it was really important that the things we were crashing into were super dry, because if we had a lot of water in them, then that would get us confused when we were analyzing the experiments. And so for that, I took some materials, like ground up pumice, which is a rock we find on Earth. And so I took a bunch of that and I cooked it. I cooked it for 2 hours at about 900 degrees Celsius, to drive off as much water as I could possibly get rid of from that material. And then we took that bone dry pumice powder and we took it to California, and then we took our water rich serpentine projectiles and we fired them at 18,000 kilometers per hour into that really dry material.
So give us a brief summary of the data that you collected then. What did it tell us?
So we collected all those materials after the impact. We can then figure out how much of the water that was originally present in the impacting object was trapped in and captured. Now, I should say that when I say water, I don't mean liquid water. So I'm not like taking droplets of water out of these. We're talking about water that's bound up and locked in with the glass or locked in with the minerals. So it's not like drips and drops of water that you'd pick up, you know, from a raindrop or something like that.
And what did it explain to us about the formation of the world then, and how much water we think didn't come from this planet? Has it made it any clearer at all?
Well, I think, yeah, absolutely it's helped clarify that question. And if we go back, right, when the solar system is forming, it's very hot. So Earth is pretty close to the sun, all things considered. And so when we have this swirling disk of gas and dust that's making planets, the spot where Earth is quite hot. And it's probably too hot for water to actually be stable as anything besides a gas. So we know we have to bring the water from somewhere else. And what these experiments show is that we're able to bring a lot of water. And that's big news, because previously people have thought that if you have one of these impacts, a lot of the water just gets lost to space because it gets vaporized, turned into water vapor, and the growing planet can't hold on to that. But what we show is that actually some of that vapor gets trapped. It gets trapped in the glasses and the breccias and the melts that are produced. And so they act like sponges in a way, holding onto that water instead of having it get lost to space.
Let's very quickly, lastly, talk about serpentine.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you have to go all the way to Japan to find it? Is it really that rare?
No, it's not that rare. The issue is that we needed really pure serpentine. And one of the things that you do is you start asking around to people and you say, hey, colleague, do you know somewhere where I can get some really pure serpentine? And so at the time I was at Brown University and I was talking to another person there, and he was like, you know, I'm looking for some really pure serpentine. And he said, you know what, I actually have some in the basement. And so he went down to the basement and got it. And that's why we used this particular serpentine from Japan, was because it had already been characterized. We knew it was really pure and people had done other experiments with it. So it's the serpentine that was available to us. We could have gotten it somewhere else, but it's what was on hand.
Very lastly then, when we talk about water from out of space, usually that leads on to the questions, is there life outside of this planet? Because everyone's saying, well, all we need is water. We're always looking for water. If you think that it might be frozen on asteroids, does that mean it might be in other planets in the universe? And is that leading to aliens?
That's a great question. So if we go really, really big, we think about planets not only in our own solar system, but planets out there in the universe. We know from a mission called Kepler that most stars have planets, and most stars have probably rocky or water-rich planets. Water is really common in the universe because it's hydrogen and oxygen. My personal opinion is that with all of those planets out there, and we've got a long time for things to evolve, I can't be 100% confident, but I'm 99.99999% confident that there is at least one other place out there that has life. Now, whether those are like little green microbial mats or whether they're actually, you know, sentient things, that's a different question. I think given the nature does a lot of experiments, right? Each planet is a new experiment, each star is a new experiment. And we know of at least one place where life arose and has thrived, and that's our Earth. And we think the conditions for life as we know it have been present in the past on Mars and possibly currently on moons of Jupiter and Saturn. And given the breadth of conditions we have in our own solar system, I find it very hard to believe that given the vast number of planetary systems elsewhere, there's not at least one that has the conditions and ingredients for life as we know it, where life has at least tried to arise.
You're covering something up, Tarek. I think you've got the key to Area 51. Anyway, thank you so much. Tarek Daly is a planetary geologist. Thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
For this week's Dangerous Dan, we're taking a flight to the most dangerous airport in the whole wide world. Because Paro International Airport is in Bhutan, in Asia, and it's one of the hardest places to try and land a plane. Which does make you wonder why they built an airport there. But anyway, it's inside this deep valley. It's on the bank of a misty, windy river. It's 1.5 miles above sea level, and it's surrounded by colossal mountains, with some peaks that rise to 18,000 foot high. Now, you can only try and land your plane there as well at certain times of the day. If it's dark at all, they won't let you even attempt it. The weather is too dangerous to try and land there unless you're between sunset and sunrise. The other way around, sunrise and sunset during the day. Now, with all these mountains, these peaks and these forests surrounding it, it's a bit like trying to do a ski slalom, only you're high up, thousands of metres in the air, and you're in a plane. And because of this, only 8 pilots in the whole world are allowed to try and land there. Only 8 pilots. Now, this is because Paro Airport is just so deadly. It's somewhere that you don't want to go near on holiday, but you do want to put it on the dangerous Dan list. Now, we'll find out why some experts think that the key of the mystery of life might be found on a bit of rock that's floating off the coast of Saturn in just a sec. First, we'll stay in space and get a lesson from Professor Pulsar in Deep Space High.
Deep Space High, the Universe Handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
Right, sit down, you lot. We've got a lot to get through. Where's Stats?
We've got a problem, sir. When Alex came through the wormhole, Chirps got sucked in. He's disappeared.
Look, we can't hang about because some silly old space pigeon's gone AWOL.
He's a Pegasus Falcon. They have the best eyesight in the galaxy.
Not that good. He should have looked where he was going. Luckily for Chirps, we're looking into wormholes today because the lesson is all about space shortcuts. Space belts on, everyone. As you know, space is so vast that if you travel in normal ways, well, it will take you a long time, however fast you go. Luckily, physical theory allows for the possibility of wormholes.
Yeah, I know. That's how I get to Deep Space High.
Technically, Alex, they fall into the category of theory because they're tricky beggars to pin down. I'm going to put some special lights on so you can see how a wormhole works. There should be a big one round here somewhere.
Whoa, it looks like space is curving into a really big hole and we're getting rather close to the edge. Are we going to fall down it, sir?
Fall down? Well, it's all relative, isn't it? We're still travelling in a straight line. It's space-time that has changed shape.
Yep, we're going down.
And here we are, 50,000 light-years from where we started. I told you it was a big one. Wormholes are like areas of space where the normal rules of physics don't apply. And as things like distance and time are all part of the normal rules, theory goes that once you're in a wormhole, you could travel between distant points in an instant.
And that's how I travelled to Deep Space High. I found a wormhole on Earth, although I hadn't got a clue what it was.
Yes, talking of Alex's wormhole, poor old Chirps is still flapping about on Earth. Can we please go and find him?
Calm down, we'll rescue him. Trouble with these theoretical wormholes is they're really hard to find. Well, left a bit.
Chirps, you made it back!
Wormholes aren't the only cool theoretical way to get around the universe in an instant. Anyone fancy going faster than light?
That's impossible, sir. Light is the fastest thing in the universe. At 186 million miles per second, nothing can go faster.
Theoretically, nothing can. Well, shall we give it a try? Our rockets can take us close to light speed. Space belts on, everyone. Stats, you'll need to park that pigeon somewhere safe.
He's...
Yes, I know. He's a Pegasus Falcon.
Now, that is fast!
Whoa, what's happening? Everything's getting slow, and I feel really, really heavy. This is like what's happened when we got close to the black hole.
I don't think I like it much.
Probably best to slow down a bit. Chirps doesn't look very happy. That shows us some of the problems of travelling at very high speeds. Things get heavier the faster they travel. and time starts to do some very strange things. It slows down. Back at the school, time will have been passing at the normal rate.
So, let me get this straight. Light travels at 186 million miles a second, and that makes everything go weird.
And it's theoretically impossible anyway.
So why do we need to go that fast if it squashes us in the process? Surely only, 100 miles a second would be fast enough. That's still astronomically fast, if you ask me.
Nowhere near fast enough, Alex. The trouble is that the universe is so enormous that even if you could travel the same speed as light, it would take you 2.6 million years to get to Andromeda. That's the next galaxy to the Milky Way. Even light speed isn't enough to get about in the way we'd like. But the great thing about space being infinitely huge is that there's still so much to discover. Maybe in the future, you lot will discover some totally new shortcuts.
Deep Space High, the Universe Handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
Let's do this week's Science in the News then. Because scientists have found that the moon of Saturn could possibly hold life. This is because complex carbon-based molecules have been found in the waters of Enceladus. And before this, they'd only ever discovered that on Earth. So while they've not actually found any life yet, this is a sign that there could possibly be some in space. Also, the Sierra Negra volcano on the Galapagos island of Isabella has erupted. 50 people have been evacuated as fountains of lava and plumes of ash are hitting the sky. And this comes 11 days after the Cumbre volcano, which is the most active on the Galapagos, erupted too. And finally, a Japanese spacecraft has arrived at an asteroid that it's been travelling to for 4 years. The Hayabusa 2 was launched from a spaceport in 2014. It's finally arrived at the space rock Ryugu, which is an asteroid shaped like a diamond. And it will now use explosives to dig into Ryugu and to scoop out a fresh sample of space rock. Right, let's quickly get another man versus animal challenge on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Before we've pitted human and beast in tests of sight, in tests of strength, today it's all about who can handle the pressure.
Extreme Athlete Challenge with the Society of Biology.
Just as the competition is about to begin, we're pitting man against animal in our Extreme Athlete Challenge. Today, we're out at sea to see who is the deepest diver. For the humans, we have Herbert Nitsch, who set the world record for diving in the Bahamas in 2010. He'll be first to go. And our animal competitor, the sperm whale.
Herbert Nitsch is ready to go. As a free diver, he doesn't dive from a platform, but from within the water.
And he's off, using a fin on his feet to help him dive downwards.
Herbert Nitsch is pushing the boundaries of human endurance. His deepest free dive is 214 metres without any breathing apparatus at all.
Quite a record to beat.
Next up is the sperm whale. Again, no diving boards here. Just takes a breath and down he goes.
Wow, he's gone 100 metres, 300 metres, 500 metres. Wow, he's now over 1 kilometre below the surface and still going. He can go as deep as 3 kilometres to search for food. There's no contest. The sperm whale is definitely the deepest diver and the winner of today's Extreme Athlete Challenge.
Extreme Athlete Challenge with the Society of Biology.
There are loads more Extreme Athlete Challenges that you can catch up on for free. Get to wherever you usually get your podcasts from, you know, places like iTunes. Also, you can have a listen on the free Fun Kids app, and they're always there at funkidslive.com. That is it then for another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. Hope your brain's just a little bit bigger. Now, we will be back next week with another trip around the universe. And remember, when I come back to chat to you again in about 7 days' time, I'd love to see a whole bunch of brand new science questions in the review section on the iTunes podcast store. So open that up, search for the Fun Kids Science Weekly, then let me know your name, drop us 5 stars, and ask me something sciencey that I can get an expert to answer for you. Oh, while you're on iTunes as well, there's loads of brilliant Fun Kids science series, like the ones we've had today. You can catch up with all of them. You can also listen to them on the free Fun Kids app, and they're always there at funkidslive.com. And you can listen to Fun Kids all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on that free Fun Kids app, and over at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.